Hello and welcome to another episode of Twimmel Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. In this, the final episode of our Strata Data Conference series, we're joined by Zachary Hanif, Director of Machine Learning at Capital One. Zach led a session at Strata called Network Effects, working with modern graph analytical systems, which we had a great chat about back in New York. We start our discussion with a look at the role of graph analytics in the machine learning toolkit, including some important application areas for graph-based systems. We continue with an overview of the different ways to implement graph analytics, with a particular emphasis on the emerging role of what he calls graphical processing engines, which are systems that excel at handling large datasets. We also discuss the relationship between graph analytics and probabilistic graphical models, graphical embedding models, and graph convolutional neural networks in deep learning. Capital One is a longtime supporter of my work in this podcast, and I'd like to spend a big shout out to them for sponsoring this series. At the NIPS conference in Montreal this December, Capital One will be co-hosting a workshop focused on challenges and opportunities for AI in financial services and the impact of fairness, explainability, accuracy, and privacy. A call for papers is open now through October 25th. For more information on submissions, visit twimmelai.com/C1NIPS. The letter C, the number one, NIPS. Also, a huge thanks to our friends at Cloudera, who also sponsored this series. If you didn't catch my interview with Cloudera's Justin Norman earlier in this series, you'll definitely want to check it out. Cloudera's modern platform for machine learning and analytics, optimized for the cloud, lets you build and deploy AI solutions at scale, efficiently and securely, anywhere you want. In addition, Cloudera Fast Forward Labs' expert guidance helps you realize your AI future faster. To learn more, visit Cloudera's Machine Learning Resource Center at cloudera.com/ML. If you're a fan of this show, please show some love to our sponsors and make sure to tell them that Twimmel sent you. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am at Strata in New York City, and I am here with Zachary Hanif. Zach is the Director of Machine Learning at C4ML. That's the Center for Machine Learning at Capital One. Zach, welcome to This Week in Machine Learning and AI.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Zach and I go back a little bit.
Yes.
He was a guest presenter at the AI Summit that I did in actually not even the AI Summit. It was the Future of Data Summit.
Future of Data Summit.
So it was a year and a half ago or something point. Why don't we start out by having you introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, no problem. So as I'm said, my name is Zach. I've spent probably about the last decade working inside of machine learning and large scale data analytics. The specific domain that I've traditionally worked in has been in the area of security and kind of adversarial domains. So paying attention to cybersecurity, fraud, money laundering, all sorts of things like that, where you kind of play a cat and mouse game with the entity behind your data to try and keep something safe and to keep it protected. So I've been doing that for about 10 years in a variety of different contexts. And for the last two and a half years now at Capital One, I've been a leader in Capital One's Center for Machine Learning, helping Capital One kind of bring machine learning into every single corner, every little area of the business as a whole to kind of spread out the future, so to speak.
Awesome. Awesome. And I interviewed Adam Wenchel,
yes,
who heads up that center not too long ago on the podcast. So for folks that want to learn more about the center and what the center is up to, we had a really great conversation about how an organization like Capital One, particularly with all of the constraints that a financial services organization has, how an organization like that builds out a capability for data science and machine learning. And we'll link to that show in the show notes. But Zach, you've got a presentation later today, actually. Well, what's the title of your presentation?
So my presentation is about doing graph analytics over large data sets. And it's a survey at the end of the day of modern open source technologies and techniques for doing graph analytics and machine learning over graphs. I'll be perfectly honest, the title suddenly escapes me. As Sam knows, I just got off the train coming up from the DC region, which is where I'm based out of. So my head's a little all over the place. But the talk as a whole is kind of an examination of how we use graph analytics and how I've used graph analytics in the past to solve a lot of very hairy problems, especially inside of security and cyber defense domains.
Why don't we start by having you give us some examples to contextualize, you know, what motivated this look into graph analytics? What are some of the use cases where it's been helpful for you?
Absolutely. So graphs are helpful really anywhere where the connectivity of your nodes, the connectivity of your data is relevant. The topology of the data is relevant. Many fields have data sets where individual records really aren't related to each other. There's a very well-known trial data set, which pretty much any machine learning engineer probably deals with at least once when they're getting an understanding of how to do machine learning in a practical sense. And it's this data set of flowers. Some researcher somewhere went out and collected the petal lengths and widths and other physical dimensions of flowers in a study in an attempt to determine whether or not machine learning could differentiate different types of flowers from each other. In data sets like that, those data sets don't really have, each element of data doesn't have a relationship with any other element outside of the class that that particular row represents. Graphs are useful in kind of the opposite area, where every single element that you have has a relationship or some kind of interconnectivity with other elements in your data set. So where measurements of flowers aren't really interrelated in and of themselves, the relationships between people or the relationships between entities definitely have a great deal of contextual information embedded inside of the relationship itself, right? So to kind of put a fine point on it, you and I have a relationship, obviously, as a result of our previous collaborations and as a result of this particular discussion here. Now, you and I both have individual elements of data associated just with ourselves, right? We're different people, obviously, but we are interconnected. And that interconnection in and of itself contains valuable information that we can learn from, which we wouldn't be able to learn if we just simply looked at yourself or myself kind of in isolation. Does that make sense?
It does. Can you make it more concrete by talking about specific business applications that you've looked at?
Absolutely. Right now, my group is using graph analytics to gain a better understanding of money laundering and other financial crimes that people attempt to commit using the modern financial system. And as Capital One is very much a part of the modern financial system, we will occasionally have individuals attempt to perform criminal activity or launder money or something like that, inappropriately using Capital One's capabilities, right? And so our job is to utilize graph analytics to detect this kind of activity occurring and make sure that it is dealt with in an appropriate fashion so that it doesn't affect either any of Capital One's customers, anyone else in the United States financial system, or it doesn't pose the kind of moral and legalistic threat that the activities that generate these kind of funds can represent.
Yeah, I imagine folks that are outside of the financial services industry might not have an appreciation for the amount of regulatory pressure that banks are under with regards to anti-money laundering, AML, but also the amount of investment that banks make in fighting money laundering. It comes up in a lot of different areas.
Yeah, it's definitely very important. Capital One's regulators have a very vested and very good interest in making sure that the financial security of the United States remains strong. And so they've definitely taken an appropriate stance in making sure that we're vigilant about making sure the activity that goes on through our bank is appropriate. And we take that responsibility very, very seriously, investing both internally and working with, working collaboratively with academics and other researchers and other organizations who specialize in this to make sure that we're as correct as we can possibly be. Because, I mean, there's a lot of, it's a very significant responsibility on our part.
And so you found graph analytics to be useful here. When I hear graph come up, I tend to immediately think of a handful of different things. On the one end of the spectrum, I think of graphical models, mm-hmm. like from a machine learning perspective, but I also think of graphical databases.
Yes.
It sounds like you're incorporating graphical databases for mm-hmm. sure. Are you incorporating graphical models as well?
We're actually incorporating a lot of things across that overall spectrum, right?
Okay.
Everything from graphical models, which would be things like obviously graphical Bayesian networks. There are some more modern techniques being used inside of the deep learning space for generating graphical embeddings. And of course, the traditional algorithms in the area of performing label and belief propagation, right? These are all different areas that you can apply inside of the probabilistic graph modeling space. We absolutely do that. In addition to that, we're working not just with graph databases in the vein of, say, something like Neo4j or something like Titan or Janus Graph, for example. We're also working with graph processing engines, such as the material inside of Giraffe, Apache Giraffe, I should say, Apache Spark, GraphX, GraphFrames. I believe Flink even has a graph API behind it, and even some more esoteric systems as well. So we're really trying to cover the entirety of that spectrum, because having a diversity in our modeling approaches really allows us to kind of explore the entire space, and it gives us lots of options to try and find the best way to solve the various problems that we're attempting to address.
So what's the best way to walk through that? How do you cover it in your talk? Do you kind of go bottom up or top down or use case out?
I'm actually going in my talk, starting with going in the direction of starting with graph processing engines,
okay.
comparing and contrasting them with graph databases, okay. And then finally talking about what is kind of a pet project that we've got going on right now, which is exploring neural network applications inside of graphs.
Okay.
I chose that flow because of a conversation that I actually had about 4 or 5 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, I was working with a couple of my colleagues at another organization and preparing a talk on using graphs inside of malware networks. So getting an understanding of how malware is interrelated. It was a different role that I was in, a different company at the time. And I was talking with some of my coworkers at this organization, and one of them mentioned to me that they were curious to know how we were going to make this kind of graphical model scale, because he said that in his experience, there were a number of graph databases and they didn't scale very well at a certain level of nodes and edges. And he said, well, how are we going to get around this, right? And over the course of this conversation, it kind of became, I think it became clear to the both of us that there's a much wider variety of different things inside of the graph analysis space that not everyone is completely aware of. Certainly because of events like Strata and the larger big data movement that came through several years ago and is still very much ongoing. We've got a really great understanding of batch processing and stream processing systems, but graphs are still kind of a niche application inside of that space. And so kind of as a direct result, when people think graphs, they think graph databases, and they naturally think of some of the scalability concerns of graph databases in that space. They're not always aware of kind of the related material inside of graph processing engines and some of the probabilistic graphical models and other ways to kind of solve and tackle this problem while dealing with a model in a graph space.
So let's walk through this the way that you do in your presentation. Graphical processing engines.
Sure.
You know, what are they? You know, what are they doing for us? How do they help you solve these problems?
So, any kind of graph computation engine, graph processing engine is going to be a system that's similar to the way we think about the relationship between Spark and Hadoop or HDFS, right? You have some system that works on some series of data, either in memory or with disk flushes, right? Disk caching. And it allows you to model your data as a graph and operate on it with a graph DSL or using, you know, graph formalisms, right? And so a couple of clear examples in the software space are GraphX, which is attached to the Spark project, GraphFrames, which is a library that's being built into and around GraphX, Apache Giraffe, which is a BSP-style graph computation engine that's modeled after Google's Pragle. There's a now defunct project, I believe, called Apache Hama, or if it's still ongoing, it's definitely died down in its activity.
You said BSP?
BSP, Bulk Synchronous Parallel. Okay. It's a model of computation which is very extensible and applies well to working with graphs in a distributed environment. It works primarily off of the concept of performing message passing between individual nodes or vertices in the graph and passing messages along the individual connective edges. It allows you to take a vertex-centric view of your graph, which allows you to calculate aspects of each individual vertex based on the connectivity of that vertex to its neighbors. A good example of this would be something like belief propagation or reputation propagation, where individual entities may or may not have some known level of trust inside of the graph, and they propagate that trust to everyone else around them for multiple hops with some kind of decay value attached. Mm-hmm. What this functionally allows people to do is allows them to label a set of nodes, propagate those labels, and say, based on the things I know about and based on what they're connected to, how do we start adding labels to those other nodes? It allows us to, specifically inside of the work that we're doing right now, it allows us to say, hey, we suspect this particular entity of performing some kind of money laundering or fraudulent activity, and I've seen that this person has transacted with 10 people around them. Mm. I don't have any view of the 10 people's reputation around this individual. What should my view be? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a suspicion by association model.
The way you describe the BSP, mm-hmm. it makes me think of, you know, as opposed to a top-down analytical operation on this graph, you're almost treating the graph as a distributed system. Yep. And like each of the vertices in the graph is transacting with its neighbors and, you know, accumulating, for example, certain properties. And then, you know, you allow this to happen over time, and then you can take a look at the graph top down, I guess, and yes. learn about these relationships.
That's absolutely the case. I think that's a really great way of kind of expressing how BSP works in practice. It's a very interesting distributed systems architecture because it allows the graph itself to kind of compute in its own manner, and then there's a concept called a superstep, where every single vertex turns around and says, okay, I've done all the things I need to do. I'm confident that there's no more work for me to do here. When your graph says, hey, each individual node is complete, then at that point you say, okay, we take a look at the entirety of the graph. We see if it's reached convergence or some other stopping function, and then do any kind of work that we have to do at that level. And mm-hmm. then we allow the next stage of computation to continue again.
Were you comparing these different graphical processing engines in your talk, or really just sharing that they exist and what some of the major capabilities are?
So it's really more of an overview. So sharing their major capabilities and kind of what makes them special and when you should be using them, mm-hmm. right? And I think one of the big takeaways that I'd like to communicate to the audience is that we should be using these graph processing engines when we want to work with very large graphs that don't fit well into memory, and we're attempting to perform some kind of computation on those graphs to calculate a value for each vertex or a large subset of the vertices in the graph that isn't easily expressed in a traversal-based system. Right, or maybe complicated enough so that way each of the individual nodes kind of affects all of the other ones around it. Right, by doing this, it kind of allows us to do the thing that Spark and other distributed processing engines are really great at. It allows us to take a large amount of data, iterate on it very quickly in memory, right, and then present a result, or more likely a long series of results, right, for the user then to interact with in a more interactive method elsewhere. And I think that one of the things that I communicate in the talk, or I try to communicate in the talk, is that we want to use this in the same way that you would use Spark. We don't use Spark, generally speaking, for truly interactive analytics. You could build probably a text search engine in Spark or something like that, but it's probably better to do those computations in Spark and then load that into something like Elasticsearch. Mm-hmm. And that kind of model as applied to graphs is one of the things we're talking about. And that's my transition point from talking about graph processing engines and graph computation engines to talking about graph databases themselves.
Before we jump into graph databases, the systems that you mentioned, you know, certainly Spark exists in the Java ecosystem. A lot of machine learning is happening in the Python ecosystem, and
I actually asked a previous interview guest this question earlier. Are you seeing any activity in this graphical processing realm in that Python ecosystem?
There's a lot of graphical interest going on inside of Python. It's mostly expressed in the area of probabilistic graphical models because there's so much, such a strong ecosystem around scientific computing inside of Python. I think the JVM ecosystem is seeing a little bit more in the distributed systems space for similar reasons, right? There's a lot of material that already exists for building distributed systems, especially when we're talking about graph processing engines that are built kind of on top or with a lot of the same fundamental concepts as some of the more traditional processing systems, Spark, for example, right? It makes plenty of sense to allow the developers to kind of have that historical basis and use those historical tools. One of the things we're seeing a lot of, however, is that in the same way that Spark has PySpark, we're also starting to see Python implementations of GraphX and Python implementations of GraphFrames that call out to JVM-based systems on the back end or performing similar computations themselves in a Python manner. I think one of the areas that we're seeing a lot of excitement inside of the Python space for graph processing is not in the distributed system space, but in the single node space, which is actually really exciting because there's a lot of stuff that you can do that is arguably even more efficient in terms of certain metrics on a single node as opposed to multiple nodes. And this has been discussed in academic literature over the last couple of years. From about 2015 on, there's been an ongoing discussion in distributed systems, the academic literature for distributed systems, talking about kind of what is the configuration that outperforms a single thread and things like that. And so it's kind of interesting to look at the, you know, kind of the two different areas where we're seeing a lot of this development. And there's a great deal of sophisticated graph processing libraries meant for single node work in the Python ecosystem, running from NetworkX to other more sophisticated tools that are very relevant.
Okay. So each of these camps is kind of building on their respective strengths, Java on the distributed computing side, Python on the scientific computing side and data science side, and kind of building extensions and bridges toward the other side, but those historical strengths kind of still remain,
right? And I think that's something that we want to encourage inside of computer science as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. You know, identifying those foundational elements that have strengths and allowing them to be good at them while opening up APIs and bridges, as you said, to allow people who don't have necessarily that specific underlying knowledge of that foundation or that language element to be able to use those systems effectively. This is a little bit of a fringe area, but there's a fair amount of graph processing work going on right now, even in the compiled language space. So right now there's a researcher by the name of Frank McSherry, who is doing a kind of spiritual successor to the NIAD system that was hosted and published and worked on at Microsoft Research. And it's called Timely Data Flow, and there's a lot of work going on there. And he is a incredible researcher. And
I've heard his name before.
Yes, yes. He's involved in a lot of things. He was one of the authors of the COST paper I referenced earlier. And kind of one of his major research areas is understanding distributed systems and when do we need a distributed system and when do we need a single node system and doing high performance computing. And so he's been using Rust recently to do a lot of very interesting things, exploring what data flow, you know, the data flow model of computation is, and exploring how that can be applied to more traditional data processing problems as well as graph processing problems. I mention this simply because I think that the area that he's working is just fascinating. And while that work I don't think is entirely production ready yet, by his own admission, you know, the work that he's doing is he's exploring the space and doing a lot of research. I think that there's a lot of stuff that's going on that's bearing some very meaningful fruit, and I think people inside of the distributed system space should definitely be aware of kind of those discussions that are going on.
Mm. You also mentioned a project out of Google. What was that one?
Pregel, P-R-E-G-E-L.
Pregel?
Yes. Much like the MapReduce paper, which you know was launched some time ago and then kicked off a whole whole new revolution in open source computing. Google published another paper slightly there a couple years after, called which describes a system called Pregel, in which they describe building a system internally that they built out. And in some cases, if I remember the paper correctly, they said that it had turned into one of their primary processing engines, competing with or supplementing or assisting MapReduce, right? Their MapReduce implementation internally at the time, at least. And they called it Pregel, which relied on the BSP style, BSP model of computation to perform these large distributed graph computations, right? And if you take
which
a look,
you can imagine that they have tons of to do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I mean to be completely clear, right? I'm fairly sure that they published this paper, and I have no idea how it's used internally or if it's still being used today. I don't know anything about that. But it was a fascinating paper when they published it at the time because it kind of exposed the concept of doing distributed graph computations, how they solved particular hairy problems in the space. And they also exposed kind of an API, the internal API that they're utilizing, and saying, okay, if you define a system that has the following properties, it would be similar to the Pregel system we have internally, and this is how we've modeled that style of computation. Again, very similar to their original MapReduce and HDFS papers, right? Or GFS for them, I suppose. And so that's it's an interesting system. I'd love to know what's happened to it since the publication of that paper. But unfortunately, I don't have that insider knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And what's the open source project that's implemented that?
Giraffe, G-I-R-A-P-H, Apache Giraffe. Okay. Yeah, I may have misspelled that. Apache Giraffe is the project, I believe, that's the closest BSP style implementation since then. I think that while both Jelly, which is the graph processing system attached to Flink, and GraphX, which is the graph processing system again attached to Spark, both have Pregel operators, so you can use the Pregel API. My understanding is that the backend is informed by the BSP style model of computation, but has been continually developed and represents kind of a bit of a step in a slightly different direction.
Meaning the backend of the Giraffe. As opposed to the Flink and the...
Yeah, the backend of Giraffe, I believe, is much more similar to the original publication of the BSP model of computation. Whereas both... my understanding is that both Spark, the GraphX system, and Flink's system were informed by it, but are not as tightly tied to the BSP style.
And so... You transitioned from talking about graphical processing engines to graph databases.
Absolutely.
How do you see kind of the state of the art there? And or maybe let's go back to the original flow. Like, what's the role of the graphical database in helping you solve the kinds of problems you're solving with graphical networks?
So in the architecture that I propose, right? I propose that users are probably best suited to use a graphical processing engine to compute most of the values that they need, right? To modify all of the properties in their graph, right? And then to output those results into a graph database, which is much easier and much more native for humans to actually interact with. I think in my talk, I actually go out and say, someone does a whole bunch of math on things, and that's great, but at some point, humans need to actually use the resultant data.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one of the things I state is that because graphical processing engines are capable of doing large-scale computations, but are not designed for interactive analytics, for example, saying, show me all the friends of this particular individual, filter that list by the following criteria, so on and so forth.
Right.
One of the things that I suggest is performing as many of these computations as possible beforehand. So if you want to do a label propagation or something like that, you do that in your graph computation engine. And then you load the graph with all of those computed results into a graph database, which is designed for people to interact with and allows you, often comes with, dedicated domain-specific languages for doing traversals very efficiently and very easily and very natively, right? So in the same way that we probably wouldn't do dynamic a style analytics using Spark, usually, we would want to provide an analyst with a SQL front end to be able to do that sort of thing. That's kind of the same model that we're applying here. You compute as much as you can inside of your processing engine, and then you pass that material over to a graph database, which actually allows someone to interact with it.
Now, historically, graph databases have had some degree or another of this graphical processing capability built in, and, you know, if only because, you know, the graphical processing engines weren't standalone. They weren't popular as standalone components. So, for example, Neo4j has long had a fairly well developed graphical programming model that you can use for data that's in the database. Is the idea behind separating that out strictly a scalability notion, or are there other reasons why you'd want to do that?
Well, I think there's two main ones. Scalability is absolutely one of the main cases. I think the second one ultimately comes down to how you're comfortable expressing certain concepts inside of that graph, to kind of relate it back to a topic that I think, you know, probably all of your listeners have worked with in the past, SQL, right? Mm-hmm. SQL is a Turing complete language, but there's plenty of programs I wouldn't want to write in SQL, right? Just because it's Turing complete doesn't mean that it's necessarily easy, or that it's really the tool that's designed for this particular purpose.
Right.
And so while Neo4j, as you referenced, historically had the Gremlin interface, the Gremlin query language attached to it, and I believe now supports the Cypher query language, I wouldn't suggest that either of those query languages are always the best choice for all of the graph computations you may want to compute, right? So even ignoring possibilities of, you know, benefiting from a distributed systems environment, right, for scalability, the way you are able to express your computations may be benefited by working in one environment or the other. Possibly due to my background, possibly due to my own biases, I generally have an easier way of thinking about graphs from a vertex or a graph-based centric model of computation, and so I tend to favor that. That combined with the scalability metric is kind of where my recommendation comes from.
And is there an emerging GQL kind of analogy to SQL for the interface between the graphical processing engines and the graphical databases?
That is a super hot topic. Okay. I think that probably the easiest way of handling that is doing your computation first, emitting that in, let's just say for the purposes of discussion, CSV or JSON or something like that, and then loading that into your graphical database, right?
Okay.
That may be a little inelegant at some level.
it sounds inelegant.
It is, but it definitely works. And actually, there's a couple of new services coming out that make doing that particular path a little bit easier. Let's put that to the side for just a second, right? Okay. One of the projects that's definitely being worked on right now is an interface to GraphX utilizing the Gremlin query language. And I think that that's one very interesting way that you would be able to go about doing this. And I would be reasonably certain that that would allow you to kind of dynamically load some data into various graph databases that may exist out there. Or at the very least, it's an area that I'd like to see some development kind of go into. There are new graph processing systems getting, not just graph processing systems, graph databases getting published on a regular basis. One of them is AWS's Neptune, which I should at this point insert my common disclaimer. I'm a gentleman at Capital One, but nothing in here when I talk about any technologies is Capital One telling you to use any of these tools. I'm merely expressing the fact that I've used them before and I've had various results, but I'm not a mouthpiece for my company when I'm talking about this. Sorry, got to do that. Neptune is a new graphical offering from AWS, which has a lot of interesting properties, including saving snapshots of your data into S3, reloading snapshots, reloading data dynamically, which might actually take the somewhat inelegant method that I described kind of at the beginning of this area of the discussion and make it a little bit more workable depending on the situation. So it's things to think about, right? taking that from kind of, I think I talk about mostly just dynamically, just loading your data, you know, taking a snapshot, loading it into a graph database in my talk. And I talk about that specifically because that's something that's relatively easy to understand and discuss. And doing something in a more dynamic fashion or a less elegant fashion is a matter of engineering and not always a matter of capability, right? And as a result, there's a lot of area that you can play in there. And that's really judged by what's your use case, what kind of reliability and speed guarantees you need to fulfill. And that differs on every single area. So I'm trying to describe more of a model of architecture, more so than these are the specific links that you definitely should be using. Because all these graph systems, at the end of the day, they're really specialist tools, even though some of them are becoming more, I don't want to say generic, but more generalized frameworks or being built on generalized frameworks. I think graph computation is something that is very, very tied to the kind of work that you're attempting to do and the kind of space you're operating in. And as a result, you want to be very sensitive to your use case at every single stage of the operation.
Hmm. And so maybe taking a further philosophical detour, do you think that in this space we need something analogous to a standard query language? Or conversely, do we not need it because of what you just said, that you know, the architectures and the way we build these applications is very use case dependent? Or is it the case that kind of times have changed, and if the relational database was being invented now as opposed to however many years ago, you know, maybe we wouldn't have a SQL because we're so comfortable kind of throwing around JSON and manipulating it on the fly, that kind of thing?
So it's funny you bring that up. I happen to be a proponent in the general case, certainly for graph databases and other traversal-based systems, to say that a common query language is likely to increase adoption. I think having the SQL standard is what allowed SQL databases to become as large as they effectively have, just simply because of the fact that you knew that you could train a series of people in a particular a particular style of SQL, and it would probably transfer in 90% of its volume to any other implementation of the SQL standard as expressed by MySQL or by Postgres or by Oracle or so on and so forth, right? There's obviously some caveats there, but in general, I think that led to many, many good things. I would suggest that standardization around a query language or a standard for query languages is probably something that will have similar beneficial effects as well. I've got my own thoughts on which ones I think would be interesting to have, but there we go. I gave you an opportunity. I actually favor Gremlin quite a lot.
Okay.
But that may be because that was one of the first graph DSLs that I really worked with or spent any kind of time with. Mm-hmm. And so that's probably a bias that I have there, but I like the standard as a whole, and I think that organization has done a good job of stewardship. Tinkerpop, the Tinkerpop organization used to be a standalone company, which before that it was a research project from one of the key developers, and they've transitioned it into kind of a public Apache project since then. And so I'd like seeing that chain of stewardship moving forward, and that's part of that key part of creating an eventual standard. I think there's a lot of good things about it. That's one of the areas that I would go in. But one way or the other, I generally believe that standardization for query languages definitely can lead to good things, and at a bare minimum definitely leads to kind of a greater ease of acceptance, certainly less shock when you deal with a new system for the first time. It's funny you bring up the statement of, you know, chucking around JSON and some of the more modern database families moving away from SQL, because I think we've actually seen, I'm remembering back to when kind of the big wave of distributed key value stores started pouring out into the Apache projects and the JVM ecosystem again. Systems like Cassandra, for example, mm-hmm. which originally was a pure key value store, right? Around, I think it was Cassandra 2.0 when they started integrating the literal CQL query language into it, mm-hmm. which looks very similar to SQL. Mm-hmm. And I think we've seen that with a couple of other databases, which kind of just talks about SQL's overall kind of cultural dominance, the hegemony that it represents is kind of very interesting.
The database's role is almost like a you know, almost like if you're using a database to serve up a model, like you're building the, essentially building the model, the graphical model using the processing engine, and then you're taking that and sticking it in a database for more interactive use.
I think you're right. I think at the end of the day, you're definitely serving the result. I don't know if I want to say you're serving the model, because it's almost a little bit more restrictive, right? Because your model, in a standard machine learning environment, if you're just serving a model, you're definitely just serving one particular thing that takes a defined input and export some kind of defined output. Whereas for a graph database, you've got a lot more flexibility. You can actually write your own queries. And at some level, you can write secondary stage analytics on top of that if that suits your use case. But you're definitely right. It would be serving kind of a pre-digested at some level, some kind of digested result in a interface that's maybe a little bit more native to your use and utilization.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then, so the next part of your talk is then starting to look at graphical models from a machine learning perspective, and potentially even, you mentioned graphical embeddings, which is, I'm very intrigued as to the direction that that goes.
So graph convolutional neural networks are a very active research field currently. And I caveat any discussion about them by saying that, like, from an academic perspective, the academic community still isn't completely decided on whether or not they are a good approach, how powerful they actually are, and what's going on. Mm. There's a lot of interest, and there's a lot of papers that have been published that speak to kind of different techniques and different approaches and different ways of thinking about and working with this, which have published positive results and material like that. But as anything inside of academia, 2 years, 3 years is not really enough time to kind of come to a global consensus on things, right? Even in the larger neural network space that we're seeing right now, there's still discussion on, like, what are we actually learning and how are we actually doing it, right? And so in a more specialized area of that larger discussion, something that's, you know, even, you know, at some level newer and has fewer researchers kind of staring at it, of course that same discussion is ongoing.
One immediate question I have is, has a standard data set, a training data set, emerged for graphical operations? Like, is there an ImageNet for graph stuff?
You know, that's interesting. There's actually a lot of different data sets that are frequently cited in literature in general, right? And they range from the very small to the very large, right? Stanford, the SNAP data sets. Stanford publishes, I believe it's Stanford, but it's the SNAP data sets, publishes this large list of publicly available graph data sets. And they include things like the trust relationship of the website Slashdot. I'm not sure what the demographic age range of your audience usually tends towards, but if you're an individual of a certain age, you probably remember Slashdot. Old kind of things before Reddit and Dig and all that other stuff. So the trust graph of Slashdot is one of those data sets. LiveJournal had a friendship listing. There's Twitter follower graphs, going all the way down to the very small, which are things like kind of a famous graph testing data set called Zachary's Karate Club, which is, I kid you not, a collection of, I think, just a couple handfuls of individuals inside of a youth karate club associating who identified as friends of whom, right?
Did you publish this data set?
This isn't me. that data set predates me. Different Zachary entirely. So there's a number of these data sets that have been published, which are very well studied. Okay. And so there's a couple of them that get changed about. And because of the fact that, ImageNet has a lot of benefits for it in that it's a very large, very general, all sorts of different images are contained therein. Graphs, which model kind of the interconnectivity of individual nodes, mean that attempts at getting one standard kind of data set are going to look very different. The PGP Web of Trust looks very different than your Facebook association, than your LinkedIn association patterns. Everything looks a little different.
Looks very different in what sense?
The number of things that you connect to, how willing you are to connect to certain things, And kind of the general level of interconnectivity of individual nodes, right? I would say that probably on social media sites, Facebook and Twitter and things like that, you're highly incentivized to connect with a large number of people. People that are your close friends and people who are acquaintances that you've interacted with a few times before, or even in the case of, I guess, both of those websites, people who you don't know personally, but they produce content or have opinions that you find interesting, and so you want to subscribe to them to get their material sent to you, right? As opposed to, say something that's much more intentional, the PGP Web of Trust, for example, for people who, you know, use encrypted communications for signing emails and things like that, those are intended to be very intentional communications, right? You wouldn't state in that kind of Web of Trust that you trust an individual you've never met before. You probably only trust individuals that you've deliberately sent mail to, who you know are the people you want to talk to, things like that, right?
So is the idea then that the popping it up a level, the density or sparsity of the networks is dramatically different in, and maybe just not the level of density, but some quality of the density is different, and that, you know, because the methods that we use to process these graphs are very sensitive to that, it doesn't make sense to have some general data set?
Yeah, I would say that's a good way of describing it, right? It's the way the graph was formed, it's the way the graph evolves over time, you know, kind of all these things are embedded in the actual structure of the network itself. And so as kind of a result, I would suggest that when looking at, you know, papers discussing graph computation, you'll usually see, especially looking at systems papers discussing graph computation, you will see individuals publishing these papers study the way their algorithm or their system performs over multiple different graphs.
Okay.
Simply to be aware of that. But there are definitely a series of these well-published, well-understood, well-studied graphs out there.
Okay.
So not quite like ImageNet, but not that different.
So then these graphical neural networks, what's can I give us a snapshot of the state of the state there?
Sure, absolutely. So the intuition behind it is, can we use a neural network to gain an understanding of individual vertices in a graph, right? And over the course of a series of papers, the concept of using neural networks, effectively modified convolutional neural networks, to get an understanding of an embedding of individual nodes inside of a graph has come about. So in the same way that we kind of look at data that is traditionally maybe a little difficult to vectorize or very, very sparse, and we want to build a denser representation of that data, word-to-vec being kind of the most famous example, but there's all sorts of, you know, star-to-vec and all sorts of other things running around right now. We would want to do that for graphs as well, because for graphs, right, if you look at it in terms of like an adjacency matrices in large graphs are almost necessarily very sparse. There's only so many people that you can possibly know. There are so many people in the world. And so no matter how well traveled or social you may be, you'll never really make a meaningful dent in the overall population of the planet, right? So for a theoretically maximal social graph, right? It's going to be a very sparse matrix. Mm-hmm. Working with sparse matrices is very difficult. There's all sorts of mathematical properties you run into, to say nothing of like space requirements and things like that. And so one of the things that people would wanted to do is, you know, to come up with an embedding matrix to take kind of each of those individual things and bring it to a easily or more easily described point in space that you can perform distance measurements on, right? And graphical convolutional networks are a means to do such a thing. And it's an active area of research right now. There's all sorts of different levels of debate going on about it, which I personally find fascinating. And one of the things I talk about in my talk is kind of what are they, and a couple of different ways that you can work with them to some degree. One of the things that I'm currently experimenting with now is getting an idea of whether or not we can use graphical, the results of these embeddings, I should say, if we can use these embeddings to perform more like this queries. So let's say that we identify that there is a fraudster, somewhere. We know that this person has committed fraud, and we know that the pattern of which this person was committing fraud is somehow distinct or unique. Mm-hmm. And one of an investigator asks themselves, how do I find more people like this? Can you show me some system out there? Can I be shown a listing of individuals who have similar patterns of their transactions or of the way they behave inside of the financial network that may lead me to believe that there's more people like this. This is a newer emerging trend. This is something we can look at. And getting an idea of what that looks like, we're currently exploring the use of embeddings to be able to kind of see what that gives us and how we work with that. And so in the talk, I kind of express that idea, introduce the concept of embeddings and talk a little bit about how you would serve embeddings in a manner that would allow you to do more like this queries in something significantly more efficient than, O to the N squared time, which is always fun.
You mentioned that it's very early in the space. Are there specific areas where it's been, or what are the characteristics of areas that has been demonstrated to be a useful technique?
So there's a couple of areas, most of them in the areas of kind of clustering, graph coloring, and association into groups, so finding community detection. Mm-hmm. That's probably the one that I've spent the most of my time looking at. There are a handful of others, of course, in the space as a whole, but I would suggest that that's probably the most fruitful initial area, identifying communities inside of a graph, which is a very difficult problem.
What is the pre-processing or training that's required to train up one of these graphical neural networks? Are you basically kind of vectorizing your graph in some kind of way as some huge sparse vector and just feeding that into a standard CNN, or have we changed the architecture? Like
as with everything, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But yeah, that's a good
I imagine.
Yeah, so. that's a good high level representation. At the end of the day, you're still working with that adjacency graph, right?
Yep.
The adjacency matrix, and you're still passing kind of the window that you're working on of the neural network over that adjacency matrix.
Oh well, so that's a thing right there. It's like, hey, we've got this huge connectivity or the connectivity of our graph can be expressed as this huge sparse matrix. Yes. But there's no way we're turning that into a vector and feeding it to a network. We're yes. windowing around within this environment. Kind of like, I guess you can think of it as a convolution. I guess that's the whole point of
that's
this.
The whole is point. That. Yep. And feeding the data into that convolution for the particular techniques that I'm working with right now are very similar to performing kind of a random walk through that graph, mm-hmm. right? So you're following this random walk, you run a series of those random walks, and then that gets you kind of what you're looking for based on a particular starting point. And you feed that, which is effectively a subgraph, into your neural network. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of papers. I'll send you a few after we talk a little bit today. Because right now, the majority of the work that I'm doing in that particular space is working with techniques that have been kind of published and discussed, and trying to see whether or not they give reasonable results. So that I'm trying to find what the best area to dive in is based on some experimental trials in the data sets that we're working with now. Mm-hmm. So for a kind of a deeper mathematical based understanding, I'll send you a paper or two, and I think you'll be able to put it up for your listeners or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you know off the top of your head some of the key researchers who are working in this area?
I'm terrible with names, so I wouldn't be able to tell you off the top of my head.
We'll include it in the show notes for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Unfortunately, many of those researchers are really good about doing kind of reproducible research. So many of them have published the implementations they had their individual papers on GitHub. And it's always really great to see it when researchers do that kind of work.
Absolutely.
That's always amazing.
Absolutely. So we've walked through these kind of three elements of your presentation. How did you sum things up for folks?
So effectively, I try to sum things up by drawing an architectural diagram saying if you're working with large scale graphs, if you have problems similar to kind of this set of things, you may want to consider an architecture that looks a little bit similar to this, right? Where your underlying layer is some kind of large block data store. You have a graphical processing engine directly over that, reading from that and performing its computations, feeding those results through some means and mechanism into a graphical database, and then serving the results of that graph database either directly through interfacing directly with the GraphDB itself or through a series of APIs, a RESTful API or even a graph.
Microservices or something like that.
Yep, exactly. Something along those lines, right? Because at the end of the day, the goal of all of this material, right, is to enable some kind of analysis, to enable some individual to perform useful work over that data, right? Mm-hmm. And so providing that in different avenues and different ways is definitely relevant, because you'll have extremely technical and sophisticated investigators or analysts doing direct line queries into the database, and you'll have others that are consuming that material through reporting or through kind of a guided interface in some form or fashion, depending on what your use case is. You will probably be in some spectrum there. And so as a direct result, we want to make sure that you have the ability to communicate those results to kind of all of those different use cases.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, sounds like an awesome talk, Zach. Well,
I'm glad
Thanks
to
so much
so.
For yeah. Taking some time it's to share it with us.
Been a pleasure being here.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on Zach or any of the topics we covered in this show, visit twimmelai.com/talk/188. For more information on the entire Strata Data Conference podcast series, visit twimmelai.com/strataNY2018. Thanks again to our sponsors, Capital One and Cloudera, for their support of this show and this series. As always, thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.